This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
While most eyes have been on Israel and Gaza, Ukraine has entered its second winter of war. Neither Ukraine nor the invading Russians achieved any major breakthrough in 2023. This week, a support package for Ukraine failed to make it through the US Congress, while at the weekend, the Secretary General of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, found it necessary in a major interview to dampen any expectations of victory anytime soon. We have to support Ukraine in both good times and bad times, he said. So why has the war become a military stalemate? And how likely is it that this stalemate will be broken? How strong is support now for Ukraine in the US and Europe? And what might it need for the conflict to end? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. Let's start with what's happening militarily. I'm joined by Shashank Joshi, defence editor at The Economist, and Michael Clark, professor of defence studies and a specialist advisor to the Joint Committee on the National Security Strategy. Shashank Joshi, I heard a respected British political commentator say this week that Russia is now winning this war. Said it kind of rather offhandedly. I mean, is it?
Russia has the initiative, I would say. Ukraine's counteroffensive has failed. It is unlikely to yield any sort of breakthrough. It hasn't met even its minimum objectives. And while there are some successes, perhaps in Crimea, in putting pressure on the Black Sea Fleet, it's clear to me that this offensive has failed. While Russia is going on the offensive or staying on the offensive in Avdiivka, in the east of the country, it's putting a lot of pressure on Ukraine. And while I don't think Russia is going to break through either, I don't think it has great offensive options. I certainly think that next year, when I look ahead, Russia has more resources, whether you count shells, which is absolutely critical, or the number of units, or many other things to bring to bear in this war than Ukraine does. Therefore, I wouldn't say Russia is winning, but I certainly think it has the initiative, and Ukraine's position will erode steadily if nothing else changes, which, of course, I hope it will.
Michael Clark, before we dig down to some of the specifics there, what would you add to that broad picture?
Yes, I mean, the Ukrainians have not achieved what they certainly wanted in this offensive. Two benefits have come through, which are consolation prizes, really, which, as Shashank says, that they've got some dominance over the western part of the Black Sea. The Russian Black Sea Fleet can't operate there now. And that does mean that the Ukrainians have now got a corridor, a narrow corridor, about 100 kilometers along the coastline, their coastline, the coastline of Romania, into the Bosphorus. So they can operate their trade, which is really important, and has been very important in the last few months, ships coming and going with greater safety than before. That's one thing. And then the second thing is that they're quite close to being able to threaten Crimea through the winter and into next year. And that is a strategic benefit as and when they're able to do that. So they're not far from being able to do that now. But no doubt they hoped to break the Russian land bridge in two to isolate Russian forces west of a big push towards the coast. They haven't made that. And they won't make that now until maybe the spring of next year, even if they get more equipment from the West, which it looks as if at the moment they're struggling to get.
Shashank, can we analyse the failure of the counteroffensive in its own terms and suggest reasons for it?
It would take hours to do a full analysis, but I'd say to boil it down, there was a lack of weapons. There was a lack of timely delivery of weapons, most importantly, delivered before the Russians had built out these formidable defensive lines in the south. But I am really keen to emphasize that if we had simply given the Ukrainians twice as many tanks and twice as many guns, it would not have necessarily drastically changed the outcome, because there were other factors at work here as well, including Ukraine's tactical preparations for this fight, their ability to conduct what we call combined arms maneuver, that is to make sure, for instance, that their artillery fire is perfectly synchronized with their tank movements. And their struggles to do that were a reflection of the fact that you had pretty inexperienced troops, some very inexperienced brigades, because the most experienced ones were sent to the east, fighting these complex battles against these deep minefields with limited training, a few weeks of training, and insufficient staff capacity, that is, insufficient training for more senior officers who could organize these kind of complex battles. So my diagnosis of this offensive is, yes, it's partly material. Of course, if the Ukrainians had five times the amount of ammunition, it would have helped. But that is not the only problem for the Ukrainians.
Now, Michael, one of the things that we were discussing previously was the attempt by the Ukrainians to bring forward a moment when they could deploy American-supplied F-16s in order to improve their air power. The inability to do that, has that turned out to be a critical factor here?
It was certainly one of them, yes, because, I mean, you know, combined arms warfare that we're just talking about requires some ability to operate air power much more effectively. And the Ukrainians never had the aircraft in which they could really compete with Russian aircraft. And Russian aircraft have now been able to get closer to the front because they're able to suppress Ukrainian anti-aircraft defenses in recent months. And the F-16s, they're not the best aircraft around, but they're the best aircraft for Ukraine in the various circumstances. And, you know, Ukraine was trying to conduct this operation without significant air superiority, even local air superiority. And the fact is, we in the West would never have tried an offensive, except in the most desperate of circumstances, without more air power. So that was a very critical lack. And the Ukrainians won't get that until the spring of next year at the earliest.
I'd like to just add a word on what we mean by air power here. A few weeks ago, Valery Zaluzhny, the Ukrainian commander-in-chief, sent a long essay to me and my colleagues at The Economist outlining his view of the battle. And what was striking about it, I thought, was that it didn't mention F-16s. And when we pressed him on this, he essentially said he doesn't think they'll make a huge difference because Russian air defenses have improved so dramatically. I'm really keen to emphasize that next year, when the F-16s arrive, they are not going to make a sudden dramatic difference, because aircraft, jet fighters, are not the same thing as Western air power as a whole. Western air power is a package of capabilities, which includes the planes, but also includes things like electronic warfare to operate alongside them, airborne command posts, the experience and the training to operate ground air operation centers to combine and orchestrate these effects and synchronize with ground forces. Ukraine's not going to have any of that next year.
Michael, let's focus a little bit on the Russian view of this. I mean, what is it that the Russians can realistically expect from their own point of view militarily from the next few months? And do they have the capacity to meet it?
Putin's doubled down on the war. He's introduced a budget, which is three times the spending on defense compared to before the war. It's a 300% increase on spending in 2021. So the Russians are now going to spend $155 billion on defense and security for the first time, having to reduce quite radically social welfare and health budgets, education budgets. So next year, 2024, the Russians will start to have to pay for this war in ways that they will notice, whatever good that will do. And Putin is determined to feed more people into this war. More and more people are being brought to the front. As and when Putin squeaks in the March elections with his 90-odd%, then it may be that after that, that he will announce another formal mobilization to mobilize another 250,000, 300,000 troops. So what he's going to do is throw people at the war and equipment. The Russians won't have their own increased levels of equipment until the spring of 2025. So until then, he's dependent on shells from North Korea and some 250,000 shells from Iran, plus drones. So they're gearing up a war economy. That won't do him any good in 2024, but it will in 2025, and he intends to just hold on. And of course, he's holding on for 2024 because he believes that in all sorts of other ways, the situation in world politics will turn in his favor in the global south and against Ukraine, particularly in terms of the US elections.
Shashank Joshi, what do you think?
The only thing I'd add is Russia's ability to sustain itself in this war has been hugely, hugely boosted by North Korea. We cannot underestimate that. You know, they've provided, on some estimations I've seen, with 500,000 shells, the South Koreans say more, but 500,000 shells is ginormous. Ukraine could only conduct this summer offensive because of an infusion of somewhere in the region of 700,000 South Korean shells. It is not going to get that kind of bonanza next year again. I just don't see it. And so North Korea's involvement in shells, in ballistic missiles, in other weapons, that is a significant and serious concern for 2024.
Shashank, does that mean that our understanding is that Russia anticipates that its own gradual build-up of strength combined with a lack of support for Ukraine will lead to a situation eventually whereby it can achieve its original goals?
Russia, I think, believes it can achieve its objective. That is why it continues to remain on the offensive. That's why I think it's not interested in peace talks. If this war goes on for years and years and Russia persists with this attritional approach, even if it doesn't bust through the front lines and advance 100 kilometers in a blitzkrieg, I worry that it can still sap Ukraine's strength politically, economically, societally. I think the survival of the Ukrainian regime is in long-term doubt if nothing can be turned around. However, I don't think Russia is simply going to cut through the lines next year. That's not going to happen.
Michael, this must be a difficult moment when it comes to Ukrainian military objectives and their own discussions within Ukraine. Do we have a sense of how those have been conducted?
We know that there are tensions at the top. I mean, President Zelensky is not getting on well with Zaluzhny, the chief of the general staff. They reputedly don't speak to each other very much now. Zelensky may actually dismiss Zaluzhny. Zelensky's got to get over this domestic difficulty before he can really reach out again to the West and say, look, we have a plan for next year and we really want you to back our plan. But so far, Ukrainian planning for 2024 looks as if it's a little bit on hold as they try to resolve these domestic problems at the top of the command structure.
Zelensky's challenge is that he doesn't trust Zaluzhny entirely, but he can't sack him yet because he's also concerned about Zaluzhny's potential popularity as an opposition figure, out of government, out of office. And so we're in this rather dysfunctional situation, I think. It's normal to sack commanders in wartime, but I think given the timing, to do so would be very, very difficult and would indicate a kind of crisis if Zelensky did so now.
Is there actually, Michael, in your view, a threat to other parts of Europe as a consequence of Russia being able to claim any kind of victory in Ukraine?
Yes, it's not the case that Russia is, you know, looking to roll westwards in an old Warsaw Pact sense that we used to think about during the Cold War, though even that wasn't really true. But the fact that if Putin is able to consolidate what he claims to be Russia's historic destiny to control Novorossiya, the old Catherine the Great Empire, it will certainly extend to Moldova, which wouldn't take much to become mired in real political crisis and fall into Russia's influence.
And just to remind listeners that Moldova is that country between Romania and Ukraine.
Exactly, yes. Moldova would be at risk. The Baltic states, certainly Estonia and Latvia, would be at some risk. And there would be a risk of a more general dismantling. The danger is that NATO starts to dismantle itself in the event of a situation which Russia has seen to prevail over the longer term. And so some of the southern European members of NATO would start to reach out to Russia, and Germany would fall back into what it does best, which is dithering. So NATO would be severely affected. The fact is, there's an awful lot at stake in Ukraine, not just the future of Ukraine, but given that the West has thrown itself so decisively behind Ukraine, and we've said what we've said, and we've said what is at stake, if the West is seen not to be able to deliver on the commitment that it's made, then the rest of the world, which is holding back, the global South is just sitting back, watching what happens. They will decide that the West actually is a spent force, and that the realignment of world politics, which the Russians and the Chinese always talk about, is indeed happening in the way that Moscow and Beijing rather envisage.
Shashank, what do you think?
All I'd add to that, I think, fantastic encapsulation of the stakes, is there's a reason we see the Japanese Prime Minister visiting Kiev. There's a reason we see the leaders of four Asian countries, South Korea, Japan, Australia, and others, visiting the NATO summit for 2 years in a row. There's a reason Taiwan's government talks about Ukraine, despite argument by some American Republicans that actually Ukraine is a distraction from Taiwan. It's because I think they all understand that Beijing is watching and drawing lessons about the resolve and endurance of the United States in wars like this. And they will draw conclusions about Taiwan and their own ability to prevail in any campaign over Taiwan. It's not automatic, but I think there's that sense of connection, that sense of wider stakes beyond Europe is absolutely there for a lot of people in Asia as well.
Shashank Joshi and Michael Clark. And just before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, which includes the one explaining Britain's record net migration figures, the one about the European Court of Human Rights, and the one about the risks of vaping. Back to Ukraine and the question of continuing support and the prospects for peace. Karin von Hippel is Director General of the Royal United Services Institute, and Professor Daniela Schwarzer is an Executive Board Member of the Bertelsmann Stiftung, a German foreign policy think tank based in Berlin. Karin von Hippel, last time we spoke, you told us that Ukraine needed to make as much progress as possible this year to show backers that they were really kind of worthy of support. In your estimation, how's that gone?
Well, what I meant was they needed to show progress, not just that they're worthy of continued military support, but also because the U.S. elections will be coming up at the end of 2024. And if Donald Trump is elected, who knows what'll happen? All bets are off. Especially as we know, he seems to have a personal peeve against Ukraine. I think we know that the war is not going well, and we have a stalemate in Congress right now, or a holdup in Congress over funding for Ukraine. So it doesn't look good where we are right now.
Now, I saw that yesterday that President Zelensky actually pulled out of an address to the U.S. Senate this week. Could you explain why that was?
I suspect he's getting very fed up with the inability of Congress to authorize funding, and it's understandable. Next week, they recess for Christmas, and so time is very short, and they seem pretty far away from a deal. They need 60 votes in the Senate, and then it needs to go to the House, and both of those are going to be challenges.
Karin, what are the politics of this? Is it the usual temporary funding row that you've got over the last few years in Congress, or is it actually more serious than that?
It's hard to say. There's certainly a growing groundswell in the Republican Party. Why are we spending more money on Ukraine than on our border? There are Republicans who are very much in favor of continued support to Ukraine, understand the security threats, understand that if Ukraine loses this war, that they could be paying a lot more later if Russia invades another country, possibly in Eastern or Central Europe. And I think that's a message the Biden administration is trying to get at. So there's certainly Republicans who understand that. But then there are Republicans who just are basically grandstanding. They are trying to cause trouble. They don't want Biden to look good. And they don't actually care about that.
Okay. This feels quite important, really, to make a distinction between Republicans who are essentially opposed to funding Ukraine because they don't care about it, or actually they don't support it, or those Republicans who just think that this issue is a lever with which to lever something out of the administration.
Correct.
So essentially, what you're looking at is not one big kind of ideological move against Ukraine.
No.
What you're looking at is several strands, and it's all a mess.
Correct. It's a cluster I'll leave the second word.
Daniela, let's look at the other pillar of support, which essentially is Europe. Now, last time you were on the programme, and that was back in 2022, you were talking about Germany's change of heart towards military supplies and spending and its agreement to back Ukraine militarily. Has Germany lived up to what essentially it seemed to promise at the time?
It has. At the time, Germany promised three things. One was indeed supporting Ukraine militarily. And to date, Germany has almost delivered arms in the value of $19 billion, which, of course, is not quite half of what the US has done, but it is still the largest European supplier. And then Germany did two other things. One is really disengage from energy ties with Russia. So there's a fundamental change in its approach towards Russia and a really very clear shift, which is sustained in terms of supporting Ukraine. And then thirdly, Germany has doubled down on its own defense spending. So it is going to reach the 2% NATO defense goal. So I would say, yes, it has delivered on what it said then. But there are, of course, areas where Ukraine asks for more than Germany is currently delivering.
Now, how have the politics in Germany developed on the question of support for Ukraine? And do they in any sense create any kind of threat to the forward support?
In Germany, we have two parties, one on the far right and another one on the far left, which question the military support for Ukraine. And one of the parties is basically at the moment reshaping itself with a very prominent figure, Sarah Wagenknecht, leaving the party. And she has constantly taken a pro-Russian stance. So there is this part of the debate in Germany that asks for less military support or an end of military support and suggests we should enter into peace deals, as naive as that may be. But the coalition and the largest opposition party, which is the Christian Democrats, they stand very firmly behind the commitment to Ukraine. That doesn't mean that Germany always delivers what the staunchest military analysts ask Germany to do. For instance, currently there is a big debate about the government saying no to delivering a mid-range missile called Taurus. And Germany is also slower than it had thought on delivering ammunition.
Since you've raised that question of the non-delivery of certain munitions, what is the explanation for this?
Basically, the production capacities aren't there as quickly as one may have hoped for. Usually, and I think that is also true in the US, once an order is given at the moment, it takes more than a year until the quantities asked for can be produced and delivered. And so right now, there's not only orders from the government to the armament industry, but there's also support for companies to expand their production capacities around the EU. So I would say the political will is there, the money is put to those goals, but it simply takes time. But the question of Ukraine is, of course, will Europe be quick enough? The criticism from Kiev is very clear. Europe is not fast enough in delivering what Ukraine will need.
Now, we've talked about Germany and we've talked about the munitions situation. Can we talk about the other NATO countries in Europe? I've seen quite a lot of reports about certain leaderships wobbling over the question of support for Ukraine.
Well, there are essentially two governments that question military support for Ukraine. That is the Hungarian government and the Slovak government. By the way, Hungary has been difficult all through this phase of the war. This is an essentially pro-Russian position, which has been around for a while. In Slovakia, the situation changed since the recent elections. And that is a problem for the EU, because if it has two countries in Europe that basically follow more or less Russian propaganda, that is a big issue. And then there's Italy and a quote of Meloni that leaked, where she basically suggests that at some point one has to move forward to, ending military support, but moving to a new phase, which could be negotiations. But she said that in a conversation which she thought was private and not as a public statement. But of course, those discussions on how to get out of the war, they happen in all the capitals. The problem here being, as long as Russia does not give up its goal, which is the destruction of Ukraine and the wiping out of Ukraine from the European map, it is pretty naive to think that we could just move out of a scenario where we support Ukraine militarily to peace negotiations.
Karen, so it's not at all impossible that the war will end in some kind of unsatisfactory ceasefire, but Ukraine must be worried that the Russians, under those circumstances, would just bide their time before attacking again. So can anything be done to secure Ukraine against that?
I think the supporters of Ukraine will need to provide Ukraine with some sort of guarantees. Now, two options are there. One is membership in the EU, which would help them sort out their administration, deal with corruption, etc. But they will need some sort of security guarantees. They can get something from NATO if that's possible. That may not be possible. They can get something from the United States, or they can get some new bespoke package that'll involve some NATO members and the United States that will be a deterrent enough for Russia to think twice before it attacks them again.
And the problem with giving those guarantees is that some members of NATO and some members of the EU don't want to give those guarantees.
You know, it depends on what kind of guarantees that they're offering. But I do think that there will be a package of some sort. I don't know what it'll look like. There are all sorts of groups that are government and non-government that are working with Ukrainians to come up with sort of with different types of arrangements that would make the Ukrainians feel safer. But as long as Putin is in power, they're never going to be fully safe.
Now, doesn't that effectively require the freezing of the war on the current lines, which means Ukraine is no longer likely to get Crimea back or the other parts of the Donbass, which are currently held by Russia?
Yeah, it depends on what things look like when they decide to go to the negotiating table. And we know the Ukrainians are also very tired of this war. I mean, we discussed stalemates, and our military experts were discussing that the campaign is not going as well as it should. But the Ukrainians have, put up such a fight. And despite the fact that they don't have the training and the expertise that others, they've done incredibly well despite that. So whenever they do decide to go to the negotiation table, there will have to be some sort of support for them. It doesn't mean later they can't get that back. I mean, don't forget, East Germany was not in NATO, but West Germany was. And Germany still made, as Daniela can tell us, still wanted to be reunited and eventually was.
Daniela, is this also an active set of considerations in European capitals?
Yes, of course. It's part of all the scenarios that are being discussed. And what Karen just said, I think, is very true, that the military offensive of the Ukrainians haven't brought quite the success that was hoped for. So the perspective of a long war where nothing much moves but many lives are lost is, of course, a scenario which is disastrous, not only for the two countries involved, but also for Europe as a whole. So those scenarios are being discussed, but it's absolutely clear that for Ukraine to be able to accept a ceasefire and some kind of deal, the political West needs to extend security guarantees. And what Karen has just outlined is very much part of the scenarios discussed in Europe too.
Right. OK. So what then finally are the blockages to giving those security guarantees? Why shouldn't both America and the European components of NATO, and to the extent that it matters, the EU, give those guarantees?
Well, I think no one says that they won't be given, but it's just not yet the moment, because at the end of the day, Ukraine has to make that move and say, under Russia, and first of all, to say, we stop the warfare, we refrain from the goal of deleting Ukraine from the map. And then I think that there will be an openness. And I think it would be wrong to compare the veto players, who are now either against sanctions or against arms deliveries, to assume that they would also block a deal of that kind, because it will be an entirely different situation.
Daniela Schwarzer there with Karen von Hippel. My thanks to them and to Shashank Joshi and to Michael Clark. And my conclusion from this is that it's not looking good in Ukraine, nor is it looking terminally bad. The question is whether the country will continue to get the support it needs to carry on fighting, or else the long-term security guarantees it needs to agree a difficult peace. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirsty Knight and Alex Lewis. The sound engineer was Neil Churchill, and the editor is Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
Hello, I'm Kirsty Wark, and this is The Reunion. Reflecting on a shared news event, a cultural moment, or just the experience of all being there at the same time and the same place.
I just started doing that voice to Armando.
When he was stressed?
Nervous breakdown, nervous.
And we all started chanting.
It just became this mean thing.
Now, all 200 editions of the Radio 4 programme are available on BBC Sounds. From the makers of Chariots of Fire to the Beirut hostages.
I do remember asking one of the guards, Brian's Irish, they've done nobody any harm, and there was a long pause, and he said, Brian was a mistake.
From the Brighton bomb to Olympic heroes.
From when you're running a world record in Oslo with Seb Coe chasing me on the last lap, or whether you're doing it in the Durham Schools Champs, the process is the same, it's just the context is very different.
You can hear again all 200 editions of The Reunion. Search for The Reunion on BBC Sounds.